Afghanistan in 2021, and the Taliban came to power for a second time. As a result, the country is once again reeling from a humanitarian and economic crisis, while the U.S. and its allies have imposed harsh sanctions on the country. The U.S. invasion of Afghanistan has left the country in a state of devastation and despair. Afghan people hold the U.S. and its Western allies responsible for their plight. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke at the last day of the think tank Valda International Discussion Club, which took place in Sochi Mountains. Presidential plenary session lasted few hours, where 140 experts, politicians and diplomats from 42 countries of Eurasia, Africa, North and South America presented their reports and discussed questions on the most painful and sharp topics. Russian President called on the West, which imposes the rules of the game on everyone, to get rid of colonial thinking.
In general, our colleagues from the United States not only set the rules, but also teach who should implement them and how. This is all done in an openly boorish manner. This is all a manifestation of colonial thinking. They say, you must, you are obliged, we are seriously warning you. Who are you anyway? Maybe it's time for you to get rid of your arrogance. I'd like to say, wipe your eyes.
According to the president, Russia faces the task of building a new world. The West ignored the statements of Russia about the inadmissibility of Ukraine's entry into NATO, the expansion of the alliance, and was cynical about previous agreements on Ukraine, which were concluded to resolve the conflict and used as a way to gain time instead of restoring peace. Putin advised them simply put aside pride and not to look at others as savages.
War, a natural war against Donbas, was launched and no one counted the dead children in Donbas. The war started by the Kiev regime with the active direct support of the West is now in its 10th year, and a special military operation is aimed at stopping it.
Putin mentioned that special military operation in Ukraine will go until the tasks are completed, while Russia has enough power to continue its fight. There will be no compromise with such Ukraine as it is now, and if there will be a threat to Russia's existence, even from conventional weapons, the Russian state can use nuclear weapons.
The United States only signed a document banning nuclear weapons tests, but Moscow, unlike the United States, signed it and ratified it. In case of a retaliatory strike, so many hundreds of our missiles shall appear that not a single enemy will have a chance of survival.
The speech of the Russian president at the Valdai International venue is a significant event and has serious international significance. This year's speech covered major global issues. This year, Putin has paid special attention to the balance of power in the world and individual regions, sending clear messages to the West, which still hopes to defeat Russia in the Ukrainian theater of operation. Putin emphasized that this is impossible for a number of reasons. I think that both friendly countries and enemies of Russia received clear answers to how Russia views current economic and political processes.
This year's anniversary of the International Discussion Club Valdai is the 20th. The main theme of this year's sessions are fair multipolarity and how to ensure security and development for all. Experts discuss the role of nuclear weapons, global economic prospects, as well as energy and food crisis. Марина Картунова, Красная Поляна, Сочи.
This is how Nida and her sister, Zinat, both students of secondary school in Kabul, spend their mornings. They sit in front of their TV and follow the lessons of Maktab Khana, a program launched by Sahar Afghanistan TV channel, affiliated with Iran Sahar Network. Maktab Khana, which means home schooling in Persian, covers different subjects from secondary school. The students can watch the lessons on TV or access them online through the channel's website and social media platforms.
A friend of mine introduced the homeschooling program on Sahar TV to me. Since then, I have been following our lessons every day. It helps us learn from home. Its schedule, teachers, and syllabus are great. I recommend all my peers listen and watch this program at a time when we can't attend our classes at school.
Sahar Afghanistan TV channel says it is trying to fill the gap created by the closure of schools, especially for girls who are banned from attending classes by the Taliban. This program is also said to be the best of its kind, benefiting from prominent teachers, high graphic and engaging methods.
The Taliban decision to ban girls from going to school not only moves Afghan girls backward, but has also concerned Afghan families. So, as a media outlet, Sahar Afghanistan TV channel found it necessary to provide Afghan students with educational programs, initiating the homeschooling program. It is going to be a ray of hope for both female and male students in Afghanistan.
The program was launched based on a realistic and functioning strategy. The top Afghan instructors are teaching in the program the best visual qualities and an engaging method, as well as a student-friendly environment, are used in the program so that the students enjoy and like it.
The homeschooling program has received positive feedback from many Afghan students, parents, and educators who see it as a lifeline for learning in a time of crisis.
I thank Sahar Afghanistan TV for launching Maktab Khana. It is a lifeline for many students who are eager to learn. It also helps them learn in a creative way and proceed with their education.
Taliban authorities banned Afghan girls from attending secondary and high schools 2 years ago. Since then, Afghan students have been struggling to find and try alternative ways of learning. In a country where millions of students are deprived of education, Sahar Afghanistan TV channel's homeschooling program represents a ray of hope. Afghan students welcome the program, calling for an urgent reopening of high schools for girls. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Islamabad has stepped up its efforts to geotag and track an estimated 1.73 million undocumented Afghan immigrants in Pakistan. The decision came days after back-to-back bombings in the country's Balochistan and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces, which left over 60 people dead. The Interior Minister Sarfaraz Bughti announced a November 1 deadline for those residing in the country illegally to leave, after which they will be deported by law enforcement agencies. This comes amid claims by Islamabad that 14 out of 24 suicide bombings in the country this year were carried out by Afghan nationals.
There are attacks on us from Afghanistan, and Afghan nationals are involved in those attacks. We have evidence present for that. Businesses and properties of all illegal immigrants will be confiscated, and illegal business operators and their facilitators will be prosecuted in the crackdown.
Pakistan has received the largest influx of Afghan refugees since the Soviet invasion of their country back in 1979. Another wave of immigrants started entering in Pakistan in 2021 after the Taliban took over Kabul and the U.S. troops withdrew from Afghanistan.
These illegal Afghans living in Pakistan for so many years are now basically indulging in anti-state activities. Many of them have been found involved in terrorist attacks in Pakistan. They were harboring terrorists. They were facilitating terrorism in Pakistan.
Meanwhile, experts say Kabul needs to show serious efforts in controlling militants on its soil from attacking Pakistan.
Pakistan urged the interim Afghan government not to allow its soil to be used against Pakistan. Unfortunately, the Afghan government has not been able to carry out its commitment on restraining those elements, on controlling those elements who are involved in the terrorist activities in Pakistan.
The ruling Taliban government of Afghanistan has slammed Islamabad's decision to expel undocumented Afghan nationals, saying Afghan refugees are not involved in the attacks which have taken place in Pakistan.
The influx of illegal immigrants underscores the need for coordinated international measures to address the difficulties that Afghan people are fleeing. The decision by Pakistan to deny entry to the people coming from Afghanistan is further proof that a more sustainable solution to the refugee crisis is needed. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
On honoring slain journalist Shireen Abu Akla, the prominent Palestinian-American journalist who was assassinated by Israeli forces last year, women journalists came together in the northeastern city of Mashhad to send a strong message that women's full participation in public and political life is essential in addressing the multiple crises mankind is confronting in today's world. The International Khurshid Media Festival became the platform for these independent women journalists to share their experiences and thoughts on stories rarely covered by mainstream media. And some outstanding media reports were also awarded. The woman behind it all, American-Iranian broadcaster and Press TV host Marzia Hashemi, explains.
With this conference, what we're trying to do is to unite with perspectives from the alternative media and to try to expand, well, you know, our slogan at Press TV being the voice of the voiceless, where we want to make sure that voice of the voiceless is getting louder and louder. And we're hoping with the cooperation with, we have people here from over 45 countries, that we can make it happen.
An important issue that was also highlighted by the Iranian president's wife, who was the keynote speaker at the panel discussion of the festival, as well as the president himself, who held a meeting with the visiting journalists.
In different arenas in this media war, where there are different versions of the same stories, it is important to give voice to journalists who are telling the true stories. In many cases, strong and brave women are doing exactly that.
And the participants are already on board.
Just as Mrs. Alam al-Huda, the president's wife, explained today, we live in a world where there is a hegemony on news, and certain news outlets tell the entire world what the problems are and what the solutions should be. And that has become a norm.
In this venue, you know, we have a situation where we can hear the voices of the voiceless from around the world, basically. We have people from Latin America, we have people from Africa, from Asia, from America. So here it's a good opportunity to start a project that can break that norm, basically, that colonialized norm. We are looking forward to a new future.
Met with the support of a huge number of independent journalists, the Secretariat announced that this festival will be held every 2 years.
The Khurshid Media Festival is an effort to bring together women journalists from across the world to cover important issues and to give a voice to voices that have been muffled by mainstream media. Gisumi Shahmadi, Mashhad.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. A historic day in Palestinian history and a day of shock and awe for the Israeli regime has been witnessed on Saturday with Operation Al-Quds Flood. The Palestinian resistance fighters attacked the Israeli regime from the air, land, and sea. And for the first time since the 1948 occupation of Palestine, land has been liberated by Palestinian forces. Towns have been retaken, and an Israeli military base is now in the control of resistance fighters. We will be analyzing the significance of this major intelligence failure for the Israeli regime and what may be next on the spotlight. But first, we're going to cross over to Gaza and talk to Ashraf Shannon to bring us up to date on all the latest. Ashraf, tell us what's going on there.
Well, Marzia, Israeli regime forces continue to commit crimes against Palestinians in Gaza. So far, they bombed and destroyed a 14-story apartment building displacing over 100 families, and they also bombed seven residential structures throughout the Gaza Strip, including one in the southern Gaza Strip town of Rafah, where at least three people were killed. And according to the Ministry of Interior and the emergency response teams, they're still digging the bodies of women and children and looking for survivors under that building in the southern Gaza Strip town of Rafah that was bombed by Israeli fighter jets. Another apartment was bombed in the south of Gaza City in the Tel Hawa neighborhood, another one in Zaytun neighborhood. The last tally by the Palestinian Ministry of Health was 232 martyrs in Gaza. This is not including the victims I've just mentioned. So the number of Palestinian fatalities possibly risen to 250 by now, and the injuries over 1,800. This is happening while hospitals in Gaza already suffer from lack of medicines and hospital supplies and surgical supplies because of the ongoing Israeli blockade in place since 2007 and the repeated Israeli wars and military aggressions over the year. And yes, this is a historic day for Palestinians and a historic day for all Muslims with the fact that hundreds of resistance fighters from this small territory, the Gaza Strip, 360 square kilometers, under blockade, under siege by Israeli regime since 2007, managed to break into the security fence, the so-called borders east of the Gaza Strip, take control of at least seven Israeli settlements there, fight against Israeli soldiers, kill Israeli soldiers, capture Israeli soldiers. And we've been learning that the fatalities within the Israeli regime, and this is according to the Israeli media, has jumped over 250 fatalities since the early hours of this morning.
Right.
To remind the viewers, around 6:20 a.m., thousands of rockets were fired from Gaza against the Israeli regime.
All right, thank you so much for that update. Ashraf Shannon, correspondent on the ground there in Gaza City. I'd like to welcome, though, my other guest now to this program out of Houston, Texas. Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist. And out of Vancouver, Khaled Barakat, spokesperson for Masar Badil Movement.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
thank you both for being with me. Quite an unbelievable day. Mohsen, let's start this in just looking at the difficulty in carrying out such an operation like this from Gaza in an area which is so highly surveilled, controlled by the Israeli regime, and has been under siege now for 16 years. Your thoughts about this, let's start from there.
It's quite astonishing that the billions of dollars of fundings that the U.S. empire funds Israel in, and the kind of money, the kind of military budget that Israel has, and it was unable to secure its so-called borders. The Iron Dome has failed. It is quite clear that Israel is as weak as a spider's web, and this so-called threat that Israel has had on the region of West Asia, and this impression that Israel has created that it is undefeated, that its borders cannot be trampled over, that it is an occupying force that is unmatched in the region. Hezbollah in 2001, in 2006, clearly proved that Israel is weak, and now the resistance forces, Hamas, the Al-Qassam Brigade, has proven that Israel is truly as weak as a spider's web. It is astonishing that how a group of guerrilla warriors are able to infiltrate within the so-called occupied territory, occupied by Israel, with the limited arsenal that Hamas has. And Imad Mughniyeh says a beautiful thing in which he states, and Imad Mughniyeh being one of the masterminds behind the resistance that we see in Palestine in the shape of Islamic Jihad and Hamas, says that apart from the equipment, apart from the military arsenal, the one thing that fights is the soul. So when someone fights for truth against falsehood, when an oppressed fights an oppressor, truly we see divine intervention. And today's events are no less than a divine victory against the Zionist regime.
Okay. Well, Khaled, let me get you in this conversation. Operation Al-Quds Flood took meticulous planning and coordination as Hamas had continued to warn the Israeli regime about the brutal attacks against Palestinians and that Al-Aqsa Mosque was the red line. Do you think the regime forces either did not take the resistance forces seriously or simply choose to ignore the warning? And what does it mean that Hamas was able to do this meticulous planning under the current situation that they have?
Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Alaikum salam.
Greetings to all of you and your viewers and your guests. This is indeed a historical days for Palestinian people struggle for their liberation and the history of the Palestinian people struggle against this brutal Zionist regime and its backers for the past 100 years. It is the first time that a Palestinian fighters, organized guerrillas, actually liberate part of Palestine. The time after October 7, 2023 is not the same as before that. We are entering a new chapter in our struggle and a new chapter in the Palestinian resistance struggle. And the Zionist enemy have been taken by surprise. They did not anticipate this attack, which indicates, and they agree to that, and they admit to that, that they have failed in noticing the Palestinian resistance operation. Tens of Israeli commanders and soldiers are now in the hands of the Palestinian resistance. Some of our land has been liberated, and the resistance is calculating every step in the way. It is very confident of victory, and the Palestinian resistance is not alone in this battle. it is part and parcel, part of the resisting camp in the region, the Lebanese resistance, the Yemenese resistance, and Iraqi resistance led by Iran. And we see that this camp, and we have said this many times in your program, that this is coming. We're not surprised that this is an offensive tactical measures that the resistance have taken, and it has been coordinated completely with all of the allies of the resistance. We see in the last few years how Israel have been committing its crimes against our people in Jerusalem, against Al-Aqsa Mosque, the theft of Palestinian land, having all these gangs and paramilitary settlers in the West Bank, brutal attacks on a daily basis against political prisoners. Over 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners are in Israeli jails. Some of them have spent over 35 years, and they are going through, illness and cancers, and Israel will refuse to even release them or and practice medical neglection. Palestinian children are being imprisoned. Palestinian camps and villages have been under daily attacks in the West Bank. So this is an offensive Palestinian and tactical offensive measure. Okay. That in one hand, it is an initiative by the Palestinian resistance, but also it is a response to Israeli crimes.
Well, Mohsen, as I mentioned, this operation has been a complete intelligence failure for the Israeli regime. I'd like to hear your analysis of this and this total breakdown, this regime that is funded billions and billions of dollars, not only from the United States, but other Western regimes, and have the latest as far as technologically and militarily against these, as you call them, basically guerrilla forces. I mean, let's talk about that side of things.
Yes, so the Israeli intelligence has absolutely failed. There is absolutely no doubt about that. And this is obviously not the first time that we've seen the Israeli regime failing. I think Israel has a lot on its hands. They were warned during Ramadan when they attacked Masjid al-Aqsa under the commands of Ben-Gavir. They were warned then that there will be a retaliation. And then when in West Bank, we see that a Shaheed, a hero, there was an attack in which 50 innocent Palestinians were killed. I would be surprised if Israel wasn't aware that there will be a retaliation. So I'm sure that they were preparing for a retaliation, in my opinion, but they weren't expecting the magnitude of this retaliation to be to the extent that it was, that they will cross borders, enter occupied Israel, that there will be a guerrilla warfare happening in seven cities in occupied Palestine, which three of them have already been captured by the resistance forces. And also, constantly and continuously, Netanyahu and Ben-Gavir's government, they have, unfortunately, they have, well, fortunately for us, they have, they're not taking this resistance in West Bank seriously. The resistance in West Bank has truly paved way for Hamas to take the steps that they are taking. There is support from Islamic Jihad now as well, as it's already been mentioned, that Islamic Jihad resistance fighters have now joined the Al-Qassam Brigade, and they're at the borders fighting hand in hand. These are unprecedented events that we had not seen before. As far as the intelligentsia is concerned, it is surprising and shocking that 7,000 missiles are fired upon Israel. Gaza is a small it's almost a refugee camp. It's a small city. And for Israel not to be able to locate these missiles, the system of guerrilla warfare that has been created by the likes of Shahid Qasem Soleimani and by the likes of Shahid Ahmad Mughniya, it has proven to be successful in Lebanon. It has proven to be successful in Syria, in Iraq. And now it will prove to be successful in occupied Palestine as well. I mean, the U.S. Empire's intelligentsia has failed. Israel's intelligentsia has miserably failed. The West has miserably failed to support its puppet Israel in the region of West Asia. And truly, there is absolutely no doubt in the fact that not only militarily, but diplomatically as well, Israel is on the verge of decline. And we truly hope that, as Rehber a few years mentioned, that Israel has no more than 25 years, to which Sayyidina Nasrullah said that maybe even less than 25 years. We see that prediction coming to fruition very soon, sooner than we had expected.
Well, Khaled, now that the vulnerability of the regime has been exposed more so, do you think this provides more motivation for resistance fighters to continue with this fight, even more aggressive against the regime, and they can see or they feel that victory is possible?
Yes, and what Israel is trying to do now is to inflict casualties as much as they can by killing Palestinian civilians and destroying houses and towers in Gaza, and just trying to cover their failures and their losses. But what is important to understand is that Palestinian people understand this brutal enemy very well. We have been fighting the Zionist regime for over 120 years, and we understand their mentality. Now, Israel is in crisis, internal crisis. Israel also is facing a very strong and mounting resistance in the West Bank. Also, it does not have any kind of strategic depth in the region, as Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and these people were trying to celebrate the so-called normalization victories with some of the Arab regimes. We understand that these regimes have these relationship with Israel for decades. It is just being now public and on the table. And it's mounting to an alliance between some of these regimes and Israel. The people of the region in the Arab world, in West Asia, are seeing the Palestinian resistance as the forefront of their own resistance against imperialism, colonization, and brutal regime. And there is a rise in people voices, people ability to fight back. People want to protect their wealth and resources, and they want to protect their future. If you look, for example, at the wars of aggressions and economic wars that the U.S. and Western powers are trying to impose on Yemen, Lebanon, Iran, Syria, Palestine, and it is always targeting people who have rejected these hegemony and wanted to bring the people of the region into their knees and submission. And this is not going to happen. So the balance of power is changing in the region, and it is changing worldwide. U.S. today is retreating. It is very similar to the 50s when the British and the French empires were collapsing. Today, we are witnessing a U.S. also are not, focusing on the region as much as they are focusing on Ukraine and the situation that is developing in Europe. And so Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance are united today in their front. And this is very important because for the past 30 years, they're trying to sell these illusions of the so-called peace process. And Palestinian people have realized that this is nothing but a cover-up to steal their land, to liquidate their rights, to end their resistance, and at the same time impose a brutal siege on our people in Gaza for the past 17 years.
Okay, well, Mohsen, at least 250 Israelis have been killed. Let's talk about what that does to the psyche of those people inside this occupied land. We had already been seeing actually an increase in numbers of Israelis who wanted to leave the entity for elsewhere. But let's talk about this status quo with at least 250 of them being killed today.
Right. So The 250 Israelis that have been killed today, obviously it is a huge deterrence by the resistance forces on the Israeli regime, because we already see statistics whereby 30% of Israelis want to leave Israel. They want to move out of Israel because they don't feel safe in Israel anymore. And I think a huge part that has been played by the operations that were done by the Lion's Den and the Jenin Brigade inside of occupied Palestine. And the death of this unprecedented number in one operation, and not only civilians, but we see that resistance forces enter occupied Palestine and they capture 55 Israeli soldiers. I mean, how many soldiers did Hezbollah capture? And we saw the effect that it had on the Zionist regime. This is 55 soldiers being captured by the resistance forces. And then in one operation, hundreds of Israelis being killed in self-defense, obviously. This bears a huge deterrence on whether or not the common Israeli citizen wants to even live in Israel when it has the opportunity to move out, go back to where they came from. They have Europe, they have North America, several places that they can have a peaceful life. But if they are choosing, to live in occupied Palestine, if they choose to become part of a system that constantly is to this date in violation of international law, occupying, garbing more Palestinian land, then they would have to face the trumpet, meaning the Palestinians are only resisting in self-defense. They're resisting in self-defense, and they have every right, even under international law, to protect the lives and integrity of their citizens.
Well, Khaled, now in reaction to this, of course, we're not surprised, but the United States says it's ready to offer support to Israel. The Pentagon also reiterated its support for the regime. What do you think that means exactly? Because it has supported and continues to support it more than any other entity in the world, averaging around $13 million per day. So what do you think that means when Washington says that it is ready to offer support to Israel?
Washington offers support to Israel on a daily basis since Israel creation. Israel received over $3 billion of military aid and $3 billion of financial aid, let alone the hundreds of millions of dollars that they steal from American people pockets and to feed this racist Zionist regime. The world is waking up, and the people in the United States are also waking up slowly, and they understand that the Israel that they pulled them at one point of time to support, the poor Israel, quote unquote, this is not working anymore. The younger generation globally, they understand that this is a racist, brutal regime in the United States, particularly now. We need to identify in a very clear words what is Israel to the United States. Israel to the United States is almost like a military camp in the region, in the heart of the Arab and the Muslim world. So it is in the interest of the United States to support Israel because it is in the interest of the United States. Once Israel becomes a burden on the United States and Europe, they will abandon this racist regime because it will no longer serve their interests. As long as Israel is serving the United States' interests, the U.S. will keep supporting Israel and feeding it with all kind of support. The problem is the United States. The problem is the United States policy, United States illusions, United States plots, United States conspiracies, United States support of the most brutal regimes in the area, whether it's Israel or whether it's the Arab reactionary regimes. This is the experience of the people of the region. We understand that the United States is retreating, and sometimes it's dangerous because although they are getting weaker, they are still supporting Israel. They are still feeding Israel, not just with money, but with settlers. When you go to the West Bank and you go to an Israeli Yunanis, they're speaking fluent English because they come from New York, Chicago, San Francisco. They're from Canada. They're from Europe. These settlers are, in Palestine, are European and American settlers, and they are there in order to serve the U.S. imperialist and colonialist project in the region in order to dominate the region and to steal its resources.
And, of course, we're keeping our eyes very closely on Occupied Palestine tonight as this operation continues. Thank you both for being with me. We're out of time. Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist out of Houston, Texas. Khaled Barakat, spokesperson, Masar Badal Movement out of Vancouver. And thank you for staying with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has acknowledged that hundreds of schools in England are suffering from crumbling concrete. The Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has been accused of failure to fund a programme to replace ageing classrooms. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Irish Times has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's education minister warned on Monday that hundreds more school buildings in England might be crumbling and unsafe for pupils after authorities announced more than 150 British schools are at risk of collapse. Britain's Secretary of State for Education, Gillian Keegan, said the government was still waiting on responses from around 10% of the 15,000 schools in England that were sent surveys to identify those at risk. This comes after authorities ordered 104 schools to shut buildings with old and weak concrete to close because of safety concerns. More than 150 schools have been found to contain buildings made from reinforced, autoclaved, aerated concrete, which has been assessed to be at risk of collapse after exceeding its 30-year lifespan. The lightweight form of reinforced, autoclaved, aerated concrete was widely used for walls, floors and ceilings during the 1960s through to 1980s, but now it is considered weak and unsafe for construction purposes. Gillian Keegan said schools that were suspected to have RAAC, that is reinforced, autoclaved, aerated concrete, would be inspected in the next 2 weeks. She told an interview with BBC, most of them won't have RAAC. It could be hundreds more. The British government has claimed the majority of the currently affected schools would still be able to operate largely normally. The revelations of crumbling school buildings just days before the start of a new term has sparked anger among parents and teachers and represents a new political headache for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Conservative government. The crumbling school buildings issue has added to the impression of decaying public infrastructure in Britain. An official in the former government put the blame for the shortcomings in British schools on Rishi Sunak, who in his previous job as finance minister had halved annual funding to repair schools when the education department had asked for it to be doubled. former Permanent Secretary Jonathan Slater told the BBC, "We were saying there is a critical risk to life if this programme is not funded properly. I was absolutely amazed to see the decision made by the government." The opposition Labour Party said the Conservative government has not taken repeated warnings about crumbling schools seriously. It charged Rishi Sunak with putting children's lives at risk by refusing to approve what needed to be spent to fix the problem. The scandals that Rishi Sunak's government has been facing its worst economic issues in decades. Also, British workers in various sectors, including transportation, healthcare, and schools, are in dire economic straits. The workers have gone on repeated strikes over the past year because of low wages and rising cost of living crisis. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story. UK teachers suggested more British children are likely to arrive at school this term with unclean clothes and unbrushed teeth. According to an opinion poll, nearly 3 in 4 or 72% of school staff believe there has been an increase in hygiene poverty issues in their school over the past year. The survey of 500 school staff in the United Kingdom who had said they were aware of pupils experiencing hygiene poverty, suggests that 71% expect the level of hygiene poverty to have increased at the start of the school year this month. Dirty school uniforms and PE kits, unwashed hair and unclean teeth were the most cited indicators of hygiene poverty by school staff questioned in June. The opinion poll carried out for charity The Hygiene Bank and cleaning brand Small defines hygiene poverty as those who are caught between being able to heat their home, pay their bills, buy food, or keep clean. Some of the school staff reported personally washing uniforms and PE kits for children at home and handing out laundry detergent for families in need. The survey, which was conducted by market research platform Attest, suggests that 72% of school staff said they had seen pupils affected by hygiene poverty experience low self-esteem. Meanwhile, 53% of school staff said their pupils were isolated or left out by other pupils in class, and 50% said they had seen a negative impact on mental health for those experiencing hygiene poverty. More than a quarter, or 26% of school staff said they had seen absenteeism as a result of hygiene poverty. One respondent said students are often left with no desk partner in class. Makes it awkward for staff members to deal with the situation. Students are often faced with working alone. Other students make nasty comments about them in front of the class to single them out. Other students make nasty comments about them in front of the class to single them out. Another respondent said they had a feeling of powerlessness, that they could not do more. Sarah Smith, executive head teacher of St Cuthbert's Catholic Academy, a primary school in Blackpool in northwest England, said, "We have seen an increase in students coming to school with unwashed uniforms, and we know that this has an effect on their mental health and overall well-being, which in turn will have a negative impact on their education." Brand Small, in collaboration with the Hygiene Bank, is hoping to expand its Suds in Schools initiative, which provides mini laundrettes to schools so more families in need are provided with clean clothes. Suds in Schools want to raise £25,000 to establish an additional 25 laundrettes in British schools. Lucy Wishart of Small said, "With hygiene poverty increasing, it's more important than ever for us to support more schools." She added, "We believe that everyone should have access to clean clothes in order to live their life to the fullest, and our research shows just how much this can impact young people at a crucial stage in their academic and social lives." Julie McCulloch, Director of Policy at the Association of School and College Leaders, said, hygiene poverty is linked to very high levels of deprivation as families struggle with the cost of things like washing machines, energy bills, and clothes. She said, many schools routinely help out by discreetly washing clothes and providing items of uniform. This has long been the case, but has become more of an issue following the pandemic and cost of living crisis as more families struggle financially. Julie McCulloch added, the level of child poverty in the United Kingdom is utterly unacceptable and the government must do more to tackle the problem.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.